seething by the sheer power of Carrie's artistry. The dopamine hit just when, as often happens in the movies, there came a knock at the door. "Who's that?" Kaufman slipped his hand under the pillow, grabbing the ivory-handled Colt revolver he'd hidden there. He'd been fascinated by this weapon since boyhood nights spent watching Gunsmoke. Caressing its cylinder, he saw again his boyhood self on the Coney Island carousel, watched by his spinster aunt Fiona, her every maternal instinct channeled onto him, little cherub Charlie, beaming as he drew toy pistols from his holsters while he blasted away at Richie and Josh Kirschbaum, spoiled dentist's sons who mocked his secondhand winter coat. Bang, 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 carousel jingle scoring the slaughter. And, "Who's at the goddamn door?" Kaufman said, clenching the gun. "Who?" Hopkins emptied his burgundy. "Or what?" "Who? A person knocks. A person is a who. But what does that person represent? What might that person bear? In drama, as in life, some people are whos, but most are merely whats. Geisel knew this well. "Fine," said Kaufman. "Who or what is at the door?" "Right now," said Hopkins. "Rising tension. But in a moment, once I open the door, revealing the who or what behind it, well, Chuck, you'll see I've brought a touch of the ephemeral, the visceral, and yes, whimsy, but also woe to our endeavors. Hide in the bathroom, Jimmy. We don't want your famous face mucking this up. You're pretty recognizable, too. Don't worry," said Hopkins. "I shall make a mask of geniality." And so Carrie shuffled into the bathroom, and Hopkins opened the door to reveal Lenny Weingarten, a 31-year-old delivery boy for the Neon Dragon Bistro, bearing four happy family meals, sweating grease through paper bags. "You're not Chinese," said Hopkins. "I'm Lenny Weingarten. The website shows a fully Chinese staff. Those are stock photos." "What are stock photos?" "Pictures of people who sell their images to others without concern for context or truth." Weingarten had studied semiotics at UC Santa Cruz. Now Hopkins, feeling himself the victim of false advertising, pressed a crisp 50 into Weingarten's hand and slammed the door in his face. "You tried to get a Chinese guy in here," said Kaufman. "And what of it? It's highly insensitive. You're the one casting a white guy as Mao Zedong." "I'm casting Mao's spirit inside a white guy and offering both as avatars of the uber demon, a raceless, genderless devourer of generations. You're using the service economy to try and make an ethnic Chinese person bear witness to it. If it's all so innocent, what's the problem? We live in a crumbling multi-ethnic Ponzi scheme society, requiring a highly policed cultural environment to avoid outright chaos. That's the problem. You live in a crumbling multi-ethnic Ponzi scheme society requiring whatever it was you said," said Hopkins, refilling his burgundy. "I am an Englishman. As for that Chinese delivery boy, he was a Jew. Would you have him out of a job? What anti-Semite?" In the bathroom, Carrie was already grappling with Mao. At first, the star tried to hedge, hoped to manage the role with safe impressionism, creating the tyrant only skin deep. He contorted his eyes, stuffed his cheeks with toilet paper to affect Maoish bloatedness. But that only achieved an Asian Ed McMahon. Then he slicked back his hair with water, grinning maniacally. But that only sent McMahon careening into Ronald Reagan. The soul, an Esalen Tantra instructor taught him, speaks through dance. So he began to move like Mao in the film reels with his Shanghai harem girls, undulating before the mirror. Reagan and McMahon falling away from his composition, clowning passing to conjuring. A harem. Intimacies with Georgie were still suffering from mutual distrust. Mao's grin coiled up through his own skin. He felt an erection stirring, and he enjoyed it until, in the mirror, he saw a sooty haze about his person. His aura. the rose-gold glow completely gone, now coal dust. He felt again the old impressionist's fear, that the throne of the self was not only empty, but not a throne at all, just a creaky barstool worn down by the weight of 10,000 asses. Where was Jim in this moment? Who was Jim? What would a Jim even be if Jim was ultimately just the creation of a billion strangers' minds? Jim was the sense of Jim persisting from moment to moment. What then of these lost moments? Panicked, closing his eyes, taming inner chaos with the shiny rod of grammar. I am Jim. Jim is me. Me is I. But how could all these things be both different and the same? He sought grounding in pure reflection, but that wasn't him or me or I there. There was only Mao's specter, grinning, taunting. He tried scrubbing away the darkness with desperate splashes from the faucet. But Mao's grin only grew wider and wider, like Guy Rolfe in Mr. Sardonicus, leaving him horrified at his reflection like some small boy in a grisly Halloween mask. The neon dragon bistro's aromas wafted in, waking roaring hunger. "Come, Jimmy," said Hopkins. "Din, din." He returned to find Hopkins rummaging through the plastic bags. "They forgot the fortune cookies," he spat. "The Huns." "They didn't forget," said Kaufman, fevered. "They just ran out of prophecies. We're at game's end, cowboys. All of us. With only one move left. Complete annihilation. Of lives, of loves, languages, and species. Somewhere it's all already ended. All the words forgotten. This life is just a sloppy flashback." "I'll take sloppy flashbacks over dead air," said Hopkins. "Let's eat." So they feasted on shrimp, fried rice, and vegetable sukiyaki, TV flickering famine horrors, the withered elderly, children with distended stomachs, piles of dead sparrows fallen from the sky. Carrie ate with supernatural hunger, slurping lo mein noodles as the viewing climaxed in handheld footage of three men in extreme starvation, their every step an impossible task, sinew and skin. They moved like tragic marionettes. "Damn it," said Carrie, as his cheap plastic fork snapped in two. "Use it," cried Kaufman. "Eat with your hands. Feed the glutton." So Carrie clawed his fingers, snatching up greasy braids of noodles and stuffing them into his mouth. Hopkins cheered. "They starve while you gorge, just as it was with Mao. Dancing in Shanghai as the peasants ate their children." Perhaps it was simply bad shrimp lo mein. Or perhaps Hopkins had spoken too soon, and his words, in distinguishing actor from subject, drove Mao's spirit from Carrie's plastic flesh. Carrie now experienced a nauseating tremor, an urge to flee this wicked seance. He tried wishing it away with the fire-breathing technique of Guru Rajneesh, which in the late 1990s had reliably purified his karmas and filled him with cosmic laughter. But tonight it failed him, each breath only spraying noodle mash across the television. The food stuck to pixelated peasant faces, blurring the space between worlds. "I can't bear this anymore," said Carrie. "It's too much." "I could call Johnny Depp," said Kaufman, waiting just a beat before finishing with cruelty. "We all know what Johnny did with Jack Sparrow." "Enough," said Carrie, with the double fear of not only playing Mao, but also losing him to Depp. "I'm trying, but it's terrifying. Do you know what it took to get my aura to radiant gold? Energy vortex visits, Malibu memory retrievals, 7-day intensive Abraham Hicks seminars. Georgie spends so much money on crystals, And right now? Right now my aura is like a toxic mist hanging over a poisoned creek with little kids playing in it. Sweet, unsuspecting kids with cheap plastic toys. That's my aura right now, Charlie. Not to be unprofessional. I'm just concerned for my humanity. Humanity? Said Kaufman. Humanity gets carpet bombed in Baghdad so you can heat your mansion. Humanity dies slowly, cruelly, in Congolese mining pits so you can have a flashy new iPhone. Humanity gets pistol-whipped in the de facto penal colonies of South Central while you eat quinoa and ogalas in yoga class. Humanity? It's a story people tell themselves to escape guilt while they capitalize off others' misery. You peddler of false escapisms, big star. You lament your lost humanity? It's a little fucking late. Then he hissed in Carrie's face with a breath so noxious that Carrie grabbed him by the throat. And then Kaufman, often slightly ill, spit phlegm in self-defense. Hopkins stood on the bed, pelting them both with shrimp lo mein. Taunting, you're worse than Sicilian street children. But the slur failed to injure as it had in his post-war boyhood. Hopkins lost his balance. He grabbed at Carrie, who was latched to Kaufman, and soon they all spilled to the floor in a cascade of noodles and profanity. They were now offensive even to their fellow Saharan reprobates, as an angry pounding on the wall was followed by the voice of a frustrated adulterer. Shut up! Sorry, answered all three men, suddenly still. Mao is sculpting history, which means using flesh, said Hopkins, picking a tiny shrimp from Kaufman's hair. It's unpleasant business. But didn't Yahweh send the flood? Mao, too, felt he was justified. He, too, was creating a people. You gotta override your empathy, said Kaufman. Can you do that? I'm trying, said Carrie. I feel very menaced. It's like he's taking hold of me. It's like he wants to consume me, you know? Along with all the rest. Let him in. I'm frightened, Charlie. You should be, said Hopkins. Mao is hardly foreign to you, to any American, really. The death of religion, the holding of industrial quotas as society's highest aim, the crushing of human lives in service of the marketplace, the rule of super-empowered elites beyond all accountability? What is Mao but the father of modern capitalism, and more, of celebrity's place within that capitalism, as a distraction, a diversion, as an ever-grinning knockoff god? Luke, he's your father. Where'd you get all that? Dark Nights. Carrie's eyes went wide. This was a lot. Don't put Star Wars in his head, said Kaufman. We'll get an Asian Jedi. Relax, Chucky boy, growled Hopkins. Don't you condescend to me. You're just a reader of lines, a howdy-doody. I'm the one who dives into the human muck to find them. Oh, Chucky boy, said Hopkins, spare us the bluster. I never bluster, and don't call me that. Both of you, said Carrie. Stop it. Chucky Chuck, call me that again, Kaufman, hand slipping beneath the pillow. He clenched the Colt pistol. Call me Chucky one more time, and you'll... Guys, stop. Who put the bop in the bop-shabop-shabop, sang Hopkins merrily. Who put the chuck in the chuck-a-chuck-a-ding-dong? Fearing losing control of his own project, Charlie drew the Colt out from beneath the pillow, aiming it squarely at Hopkins, who lunged to disarm him. As they grappled, Charlie's soy-sauced, slicking fingers slipped on the trigger, firing off a round that grazed Carrie's shoulder. The blast left them all in shock, ears ringing. Touching the wound, Jim experienced no horror, little pain, only a giddy thrill and the warm, dawning realization that he'd never felt so alive. A twisted grin overtook his face. Mao's spirit is well with us, said Hopkins. Let's call it a day. He and Carrie departed, leaving Kaufman all alone in the sorrowful room. For a while, he just lay there on the comforter, calming himself with breathing. Then he reached for a small box on the bedside table, opening it with care. Inside, laid on tufted cotton, were the bodies of Jan and Dean, his beloved butterflies. Gently, he stroked their wings, imagining the moment as a scene from his masterpiece. How the digital effects team would bring the creatures back to life. How they'd flap from his fingers and flit across the room. Wings shining in fluorescent light. There would be no such peace, real or imagined, for Carrie. Awaiting him at home was the script for Disney's untitled Play-Doh Fun Factory project. Usually he ignored such fluff, but this was different. Marked as high priority, messengered from the Creative Artists Agency, a large-scale cultural reprocessing facility in the California desert. Jerry Karkarias had attached a handwritten note. "Hey, Jim. Jack Black, Jude Law, Antonio Banderas, Katy Perry, Zoe Saldana, Wesley Snipes attached. Jackie Chan circling as well. Do you know what that means in Asia? Good chance to show you can play well with others. You're my favorite. Jerry." Once he'd entered Rome in triumph. And now, a feature-length commercial for Hasbro? He dressed his shoulder wound, then climbed into bed beside Georgie, falling through garbled thoughts into a nightmare version of the memory whose retrieval he'd resisted under the guru Natchez Gushu. 40 years ago, his family had lived in a fieldstone caretaker's house while working at the Titan Wheels factory outside Toronto. Now he was back there. It was winter, cold. Filthy snow at his feet. They'd taken jobs as janitors after his father lost the accounting position he'd held for 30 years. Fired by his own brother-in-law, Bill Griffith, a man whose name, across Percy Carey's struggle, became a byword for cruel fate. "Fucking Bill Griffiths," he'd spit when his cheeks bounced. "Fucking Bill Griffiths," he'd sigh to the mirror as he noticed his hairline receding. In the dream, Carrie approaches the sad little house, peers through its winter-brittle windows, and sees his mother, Kathleen, kneading onions and celery into ground chuck, a family staple bought at discount a day before its expiration from DiPietro's supermarket. Its aroma, from a distance, often fooled him into thinking they were having steak. He calls. She doesn't answer. He turns from the house toward the factory's gray hulk, its floodlights cutting through the dusk. He knows that he's expected inside. He walks, shivering across the empty lot. He enters through the loading dock, punches the time clock, goes into the workers' locker room, pulls on his janitor's coveralls, laces up his steel-toed Greb Kodiak work boots, and tugs on his yellow rubber gloves. He finds his mop and his wheeled trash can and pushes them into the bathroom where his shift always begins, where the Jamaican workers would shit in the urinals to amuse themselves and torment him. He scoops out a slick turd with his rubber-gloved hand, scrubs the porcelain with disinfectant, gagging as he breathes. He hears a playful jingle, like from an ice cream truck. It grows louder, beckoning. He follows it down a dingy corridor toward the steel doors that open onto the factory floor, where his father and brother work. But now they reveal something quite different from years ago. It's no longer the Titan Wheels factory. It's a Play-Doh fun factory. All machines candy-colored, belching gusts of glitter that sparkle in the rainbow lights. "Jimmy," he hears his father's voice from above and looks up to see him trapped in a huge neon pink funnel, his legs minced by giant blades painted with rainbows. They've chopped him up to the waist, but Percy Carey is still beaming, a vision of Catholic martyrdom eyes fixed on heaven. "Fight it, Dad," cries Jim, decades of anguish finding voice. "Why don't you ever fight it? Why'd you take us here? Why'd you just give up like you did?" "The fun factory is not the worst place to work," replies Percy with a shrug. "It's chopping up your legs." "Don't fucking talk to fucking Dad like fucking that," another familiar voice bellows from across the factory floor. Carrie turns to see his beloved big brother John, trapped in a similar machine, also devoured up to his waist. "You're the fucking unhappy fucking one, Jim. Fucking you with your fucking insecurities, your fucking suppressed rage and your needy fuckingness. It's fucking-thetic. We fucking pray like mad whores for you. I swear to fucking God." "You make me sound awful," says Carrie. "I'm happy enough. I didn't do so bad. Made some good movies. I have a good domestic partner. Rub fucking that in my fucking face, why don't you? God, you say fuck a lot. What are you, my fucking mother?" This would be their last exchange. John bucks up and down in the funnel before, with a final utterance of his favorite profanity, he slurries through the factory's tubing. "Can you get me my smokes?" calls Percy as the blades gag on his femurs. "Could really use one." "Why didn't you sue them when they fired you?" "Good men don't sue, son," Percy says as the blades snap his pelvis. "Fucking Bill Griffiths." "It's not Bill Griffiths. You could have done so much more. You had talent. Why'd you let them take your life away? Why didn't you fight?" Percy shrugs. "One day it just got dark for me."
"So you gave up on your dreams?"
"I didn't give up any dreams," said Percy, now short of breath. "One day you made me laugh so hard my teeth fell out. After that, I was dreaming for you." Suddenly ashamed of his anger, Carrie climbs up the funnel, straddling its rim, reaching for his father's hand. But the gears pull Percy down to his neck, arterial blood spraying everywhere, coating the funnel. Jim slips, scrambles, trying vainly to find a grip. But the walls are too steep, too slick. Down into the fun factory Carrie goes, steel teeth crushing his bones. The factory's cloying jingle soaring as it pulls him down to the knees, then the waist. Futile clawing, no escape. It chews him up to his shoulders, his neck, then blackness. By its own twisted logic, the dream returns to the little fieldstone caretaker's house. The factory becomes the kitchen. He and his father are now ground human meat, sizzling in a gigantic frying pan alongside onions and celery, tossed by his mother's spatula. "Mom, it's me! Turn off the stove!" screams Carrie. But his words are just the squeaks of bubbling grease. "She can't hear us, son," says a clump of meat beside him. "She's in pain." Carrie thrashed in the sheets, sweat-soaked, wailing, waking Georgie beside him. A month ago, she would have woken him, would have held him and talked him back from the nightmare. Now, with their love touched by contempt, she only watched him flail and whimper, fascinated, even satisfied, to see the mighty star so helpless. Chapter 7. Carrie woke to find Georgie gone, off to a screenwriting class she was taking with Caprice Wilder. He had no memories of the Fun Factory, only a sense of submerged menace from which he sought escape through a Buddhist teaching that the mind is untrustworthy, a sewer of illusions. The problem with this, of course, is that as all the world's minds are linked together, the sewer runs ever fouler, ever deeper. He was just out of bed, standing in the kitchen with his coffee, when his publicist, Sissy Bosch, emailed, alerting him to a deep fake video that had almost overnight gained such virality as to merit concern.
Somewhere in the Korean peninsula, a tech-savvy pervert had feminized Carrie's features, given him long raven tresses, and then spliced this new female face onto the bodies of evidently incestuous lesbian twins. Their performance, in the subsequent HD video, had become a phenomenon through sheer exuberance, earning 10 million views overnight. And tempting his hand beneath his bathrobe when, after clicking on the link, he saw his two digital female selves in fevered coitus. How very smoldering his eyes were in that heavy mascara. How pouty his red-painted lips. How breathtakingly symmetrical his four teardrop breasts. How coy his gasps and giggles. Was this a pent-up transsexual drive finally given outlet? Or merely a particularly intense expression of masturbation's guiding narcissism? Despite Sissy's fears of brand catastrophe, he had no worries about copyright infringement, authorship, ownership. He watched, transfixed, fascination overriding all concerns for the strangeness of this new dimension. He dreamed himself alongside his female selves as they wrote each other through pornography's Persepolis. Far from wanting to sue anyone, Carrie longed only to pass through the screen, to caress and be caressed, to meld with these female versions of himself in some ultimate feat of completion. How effortlessly they would read the language of one another's faces, nothing to hide. No need to perform. I'd be totally understood. It had been decades since film had captured him so entirely. He forgot his coffee and lusted into the screen, jackhammering away at himself in the laptop light. And he might well have climaxed, but for the biting thought that suddenly consumed him. If these South Korean lesbian Jim Carreys could get 10 million views overnight. Did it even matter what he, the actual Jim Carrey, did or didn't do with his talents? He'd fought all his life to build and control a public persona. And now he'd not only been drafted into amateur porn, but was performing in duplicate without pay of any kind. As if sensing this surface fracture of the self, a pop-up ad offered him a hot deal on numbness, a commercial for the loveliest fast food delicacy he'd ever seen, the Wendy's Honey Butter Chicken Biscuit. Its deep-fried surface was shot in dreamy HD, buns supple and crusty. He wanted only to eat these biscuits, to drown them in the two new dipping sauces whose names, Zesty Barbecue, Honey Mustard, were sung by an off-screen gospel choir as they drizzled across the frame. He raced to his Porsche, salivating. As he tore down Hummingbird, an inner voice assured him that two of the Wendy's breakfast biscuits would set him right. But at the drive-through window, another inner voice rose up from somewhere altogether more dangerous and desperate. "Give me five of the honey butter chicken biscuits." It wasn't comfort he was seeking here. It was stupor, a complete if fleeting escape from thought and emotion. He devoured two of the sandwiches, slathered in zesty barbecue, while slow cruising down Sunset, and another pair in the Saharan Motel parking lot, heavy with honey mustard. Then he shuffled past the pool, entered Kaufman's room, and plopped down on the bed to eat his final biscuit. He had one tub of each dipping sauce remaining, and as he peeled off their foil covers, was drawn into the ancient tug of war between sweet and savory. Wanting to extract all possible pleasure from this last hunk of heaven, he dipped it between the sauces, enjoying both taste experiences and initially a dramatically enhanced sense of personal freedom. Would the next bite be zesty barbecue or honey mustard? Across all wild creation, only he knew. And what smug assurance that brought him until the second sliver when, in his very hand, the biscuit changed course to zesty barbecue, while only a second before, with all certainty, he'd chosen honey mustard. What force separated a person's actions from their will? What caused Jim Carrey at 10:03:28 in the morning to usurp the biscuit-dipping plans he'd made a mere half-second before? Was it fate? Chaos? If so, what or who was he? He chose to choose the sauce he didn't want, just to prove that he was real. "Eat it, ass clown," he muttered, lowering the biscuit down toward the honey mustard with slow stealth, like a cat about to pounce on prey. "Everything okay, Jim?" said Kaufman, watching. And Carrie gave him eyes that said nothing could ever be promised. "We're nearly there," said Hopkins. "Mao's task, you will recall, was to demolish the past, to remake China as a dignified global power, no opium den of colonial exploitation. This goal was gruesomely pursued, but at length, as we see every day, it was achieved." With a click of the remote, he began the day's viewing. A slick state propaganda film on color stock garished across the flat screen. Footage of Chinese military and party officials gathering in the Gobi Desert, wearing special glasses like mid-century teens at a 3D drive-in. Carrie lay in a lipid daze, a person watching reels of people watching, their anticipation fueling his own as a Mandarin voice began a countdown. Shu, Jiu, Ba. At zero came a burning flash, then a gnarled junior mushroom cloud. "China's first nuclear explosion," whispered Hopkins. "Mao's seat finally at the table of nuclear powers, the equal of Truman, of Stalin. Feel his triumph as your own, Jim." Then came the obligatory nuclear wreckage reel. Carrie was enthralled, a toddler at a monster truck rally. Makeshift huts vaporized. Shockwaves snapping telegraph poles. A cage of baby goats, fur so soft he wanted to adopt them all. He connected cozily to their latching infant eyes until they were carbonized. Then soldiers charged into the detonation site, 1,000 sacrificial extras striking poses for the cameras, heroically oblivious to the poisoning radiation. Carrie's mind flashed images of their eventual flesh-bubbling ends. He lost all Maoist indifference. He mourned these men who, like him, had once been fresh and new, had picked up feathers fallen from the sky. Then all his chakras curdled with the grand finale, a scene inspired by Hollywood westerns, 1,000 riders and horses wearing gas masks and UV visors, tragic cavalry galloping into ghostdom. He felt a horrific peril. At what point did the portrayal of evil become evil itself? "Turn it off," he howled. "I don't want to exploit this. I don't want to even try to understand it." "It's the birth of modern China," said Kaufman, "and with it, modern capitalism. It's a crying slaughter." "Wussy," spat Hopkins. "Buck up. I'm not a wussy." "Then play on." "I mean it, Tony. I'm gonna puke. It's that gross breakfast you ate." "It's not the Wendy's," said Kaufman. "It's the actor. Stuck on his own trite moral vanity. We should have gone to Johnny Depp or Bale. Bale's not afraid of anything. Call him. I don't need this evil inside of me." "But it's already there," said Hopkins, shrieking out from ancestral memory. 2 million years of rape and murder coded into your every cell. "I'm feeling unwell right now. That's Mao making himself at home." "Oh, Christ, Tony, I'm so afraid." "Have courage," said Hopkins. "One more push." So began the final rite, footage from Mao's greatest caper, the Cultural Revolution. For 3 hours, they watched Chinese youth rising up by the million, riding trains across the countryside, marching through the cities, students burning books, toppling statues, even raising buildings whose aesthetics dared to evoke any time before Mao's, filling up city squares, inflicting abuse and brutal struggle sessions on perceived inheritors of privilege, believing madly that crimes in the present could cure wrongs in the past. Half the population, it seemed to Carrie, was lost in a cultish fervor, the rest cowering in fear. "Anyone can rejigger an atom bomb," said Hopkins, "but to possess the minds of millions? To make them your willing zombies across a whole decade? That's real magic." By 1966, Mao was old and paranoid, fearing plots against his rule. His wife, Madame Mao, was once a famous Shanghai actress. Now she became his partner in conquering Chinese culture. They ordered every film released in China to feature him as its mighty hero. "Really," said Carrie, "even more. They had every printing press churning out his image deep into the billions. Crowds hailing him in every town, chanting his teachings and waving his picture." "Isn't that appealing?" asked Kaufman. "It's how it was for me after the mask," said Carrie wistfully. "I had my own action figures, millions of them, hauled around the world by speed-popping truckers. My face, it was gigantic, pasted on endless billboards. Even the Maasai knew me, I'm not sure how. I was on safari in Kenya with my daughter. They gave me a tiny bow and arrow and invited me to shoot up termite mounds." "That movie stayed in theaters forever," said Kaufman. "I saw it 3 times. "So did I," said Hopkins. "And so did Kenneth Branagh." Carrie wanted back there. He wanted it so badly, to reclaim that adulation, that power, that industrial heat, and a reprieve, however long or brief, from stardom's gray afterlife, the dim flickering realm of John Barrymore and Bela Lugosi. He hung on Hopkins' words like keys to salvation. "Only the young," Mao said, "could save China. And only by destroying his enemies." He became, for them, greater than the Beatles and the Stones and the hula hoop combined. They joined him en masse, heeding his edict to eradicate, crushing all opposition. Imagine that kind of power, Jimmy. "Any studio head who gives me shit gets sent to an Orange County labor camp," said Carrie, eyes suddenly gleaming. "Flog all the lawyers in the town square. Bring every critic to heel. Hang the paparazzi from their own camera straps. I shall admire their lifeless bodies as my parade moves past. See them dangling from every palm tree in the Palisades." "Yes, now make it Mao," commanded Hopkins. "Say it. I, Mao Zedong, command the world." "Give me a rural Chinese accent while you're at it."
"I, Mao Zedong, will the..."
"That's you impersonating a Chinese person, a cop-out. I want Mao's spirit speaking through you."
"I, Mao Zedong..."
"Deeper!" Hopkins grabbed Carrie's groin. "Yes, feel it in your nutsack."
"I, Mao Zedong," boomed Carrie, "can will the end of all things."
Carrie rose and strode to the window, peered through the slatted blinds out onto the courtyard swimming pool. He recalled, it seemed at random, his first stab at fame, decades before, aged 18, standing in line with his father Percy outside Toronto's NIB, the National Institute of Broadcasting, a hustle promising to make a network anchor of anyone with $800 and a free afternoon. They saved up their cash, drove 7 hours to wait forever with 300 other suckers, cross-eyed stutterers, would-be weathermen with facial tics, souls devoid of charisma, sadder than a scene from Lourdes. Years later, when he got famous, the NIB took out full-page ads in the Hollywood Reporter, sending congratulations, claiming to have given him his first break by suckering him and his dad out of their cash. He remembered how they had laughed at their own conning, broke on the cold city sidewalk. Is there a dormant, anarchic urge in all of us? A violent child waiting to be born? Now the monster overtook him. Carrie stepped onto the terrace and imagined, gathered down below, a sea of Mao's youth brigades cheering his name, calling him down onto Sunset Boulevard, clogged with thousands more of their kind, freshly bleached minds. Scenes from Cleopatra infect the fantasy as they hoist him onto a jewel-encrusted litter where his two lesbian female selves kneel by his throne, dressed like Egyptian slaves in leather collars and gold chains. They coo in semi-orgasm as Carrie gives his minions an adequate, if hackneyed, command. To glory! That sets off the frenzy. His youth brigades rampage across the city, a giant human fist, all actions willable by his whims. He dreams them out to Burbank, surging through the gates of Walt Disney Studios, ransacking the office suites, burning every last trace of the Play-Doh Fun Factory project before, in a stirring close-up shot, ripping Walt Disney's head from its cryogenic freezer and tossing it among them like a beach ball. Carrie preens and claps, his only concern whether to watch Disney's head decompose in the sun or toss gold coins to the acrobats who soar and tumble for his delight. Then his acolytes topple the statues of the seven dwarfs, finding beneath them a secret underground laboratory filled with mutant mouseketeers, a colony of lab rat funicellos and pharma chimp cubbies. There's a fine line between a mouse and a rat, a finer line still between a rat and a bat. Through abominations of genetics, these children ran the whole spectrum, looking up from aluminum feed troughs of Pez and raw chicken to hiss at the sunlight, their fangs bared, their skin translucent from years below ground, faces caked with filth. Once liberated, but are they really free? They join the Carrie Brigades as a spear-tipping horror, gnawing off the faces of the LAPD riot troops, clearing the way for the rest to come charging up Rodeo Drive, toppling all the luxury cars, firebombing the fancy boutiques, news choppers hovering above, the well-coiffed reporters all weeping for their own crashing housing values as the horde turns down the Avenue of the Stars towards CAA's headquarters. There they pause, all eyes fixed on the master. Carrie raises a powerful hand, gestures grandly, slowly, toward the building, then, with a nod, says, "Spare no one." His faithful bear down on the Armani-suited agents who scurry like vermin to the roof, where, surrounded, Jerry Carcarius pleads, "I'm so sorry about the Play-Doh Fun Factory. I should never have tried to package a great artist like Jim Carrey into that gross head cheese. Forgive me." "Nuh-uh," says Carrie. "Please." "Afraid not." Carcarius grovels, but Carrie plugs his ears with his fingers and begins making gibberish sounds against which his minions toss poor Jerry Carcarius from the roof, then unfurl a gigantic silk banner into the wind. A field of deep Chinese red, printed with an image of Jim Carrey's face so perfectly morphed with Mao Zedong's that there is no telling where the one man ends and the other begins. Chapter 8. Charlie Kaufman hopped a flight east, believing that a Taiwanese billionaire, still miffed about Mao, was eager to finance his project. Before departing, he encouraged Jim to immerse himself in radical Marxist message boards, to perfect Mao's accent with coaching from his friend Carrie Elwes, a master of dialects whose great-grandmother, the noted linguist and reputed SIS triple agent Lady Winifred Mary Elizabeth Elwes, wife of Gervais Henry Elwes, would scold him in Cantonese when he was a small boy. Further, he asked the star to gain at least 30 pounds, to arrive as close as he could to Mao's emphysema by chain-smoking, and, perhaps most injuriously, to visualize and refine the death scene from Kaufman's film treatment. So it was that each morning, in place of healing mantras, Carrie would lie in bed, clear his mind, and, with all of his actorly prowess, fuse his being with that of the dying Mao. Acutely aware of his breathing, eyes closed in dark prayer, he soon could feel the embalming tubes plugged into his veins, could hear the teams of physicians whispering around him. Some days, tears of self-pity would stream down his cheeks as he imagined the final shot from Kaufman's pages. Mao's eyes dissolving into his own, joining tyranny and celebrity. Then, more or less satisfied, he'd moved into his favorite part of character preparation, the weight gain. Georgie blessed this whole enterprise, half hoping a lauded Mao turn would fill his inner chasms, half just for the amusement. At breakfast, she'd watched as Carrie ate grilled cheese and bacon sandwiches, slabs of French toast soaked in maple syrup. Many nights he'd dine at the Little Door in West Hollywood, guzzling vintage wines, pleasing himself with escargot and foie gras as a warm-up for bacon-wrapped filet mignon with sides of truffle fries and gratin de finois. Some days, with Maoist gut greed, he'd eat 5, 6, 7 Wendy's chicken biscuit sandwiches. No concerns for body mass now, unquestioned commander of his dimpling fingers. Gone was the honey mustard conundrum, and with it, the old uncertain Jim Carrey. Now he was himself, yes, but also Mao, realizing more and more each day that raw appetite had always been the link between celebrity and tyranny. Then he'd waddle down to the pool, both jovial scampering at his sides, licking traces of sugar and grease from his face and fingers as he sat by the water's edge, gladly taking their hunger for love. Heart and belly full, he'd paddle out lazy laps, imagining his swimming pool as the Yellow River, recordings of great communist speeches playing from all the outdoor and underwater speakers. America's brutality made slightly more sense as he heard the words of Trotsky. Everything that should have been eliminated from the national organism in the form of cultural excrement in the course of the normal development of society has now come gushing out from the throat. Capitalist society is puking up the undigested barbarism. Sometimes he'd let the pool jets massage his back, pondering Marx. In bourgeois society, capital is independent and has individuality, while the living person is dependent and has no individuality. One day, his whole abdomen cramped after a lunch of Frito pies. Struggling toward the side of the pool, fearing for his life, he wondered what his legacy would be if he expired then and there. And in this moment of crisis, Carrie joined so many millions in having Mao's thoughts transform his view of the self and the world. The overthrown bourgeoisie tries by hook or by crook to use literature and art to corrupt the masses. What, he wondered, desperately climbing from the water. Was Plato as a toy but a corrupt and failing capitalist imperialist society fetishizing its own excrement? Dumbing its children down from birth, taunting them with what they could expect in place of real dreams, real lives, in exchange for any chance at real souls. Crap. What then was the Plato fun factory but a foul celebration of exploited labor? He knew factories. No one had fun in factories. They sweltered and slaved, hunched and harried. People reduced to things, manufacturing so much meaningless plastic shit that made no one happy, poisoned the oceans, corrupted the food chain. The modern world was a burning bus speeding toward a cliff with a maniac at the wheel. And he was not a part, but complicit, a hyperactive child making yuck-yucks in his seat, keeping everyone laughing, distracting them from certain doom. Faster, faster, no more room to break. Suddenly, Disney's untitled Plato Fun Factory project was the devil's work, and it offended him now as a matter of revolutionary principle. Wink Mingus, Al Spielman, and Jerry Karkarias, suddenly they were all class criminals, deserving whatever they might get. Suddenly, he knew that Mao could not live in him without destroying Hollywood, and that this campaign must begin with Disney's Plato project. More and more, his representatives were calling, pestering him to join the toy-based abomination against Kaufman's assurances that funding for Mao was just one card game away. As if stepping into the role of Madame Mao, Georgie suggested they use her 40th birthday as a trap. Together, they planned a Chinese-themed party in the Hummingbird backyard. The grand estate became a stage on which Carrie's Mao Zedong would deal Disney's Play-Doh Fun Factory project a mortal blow. On the night of the party, Carrie's maple trees, planted to evoke his Canadian home, were all festooned with Yunnanese cherry blossoms that had been FedExed overnight. His swimming pool was stocked with a higher class of surface-feeding carp, gold and amber bodies sparkling in the sunlight while a Chinese string quartet played harvest songs. Greeted by tumbling acrobats upon arrival, the guests simply believed themselves the lucky recipients of a generous star's love for his wife, a man who had, for his own reasons, on a pricey whim, decided to transform his Brentwood estate into a regal Shanghai villa. The Disney executives floated about the lawn of bantering A-list guests, bathing in overheard conversation. "I'm in love with you," said Quentin Tarantino to Georgie. "With me?" "Yeah. From Oksana. The scene in the sewers. Stalin, what a dick. You and the power drill. How'd you sneak all that blood onto basic cable?" Mitch was into swapping reels at the last minute. "An anarchist. Yeah, that's what got him, that and the whole extraterrestrial arc." Was he a believer? I hope so. He once left the set for a whole week, walked 80 miles into the San Gabriels to take a meeting with a guy he thought created the human species. "I've watched every episode." "Of Oksana?" "Yeah. I love all that Soviet shit. The fucking Nazis killed 20 million Russian men in World War II. That's why the women are so beautiful. The survivors got to be picky as fuck. The women think they're over the fucking hill at 24 and they start putting all that silver makeup on. And shit, it still haunts them, man. It's why they're paranoid. It's why they sent that Turkish guy to kill the Pope. I've been noodling around that, the Turkish guy and the Pope. The Vatican's got two flying saucers. Howard Hughes said he got to sit in one. And that was before he was all fucked up. Hey, did Stalin really jizz in Dixie cups, or was that just a conceit? Dixie cups? Or not Dixie cups, whatever fucking cups the Russians had. Commie Dixie cups. The whole bastard daughter thing. Your origin story. Fuck, I love you. Los Angeles, the city built on golden sun and grand prizes, required strong belief in magic. Slight derangement was the first stage of the human filtration process, and she read it on his face as he spoke. The unhinged exuberance that had turned a video store clerk into a legend and which now, by momentary contagion, showed her that the whole path here had been worthwhile. Quentin Tarantino knew her. Quentin Tarantino was her fan. Seems likely in that he was a maniac. Tarantino was in full stride. Crazy people love to play with their spunk. Soviet Union, Uncle Joe, Mother Russia. I've been circling the space, noodling. We should have a meeting. A meeting? Georgie asked. I got my eye on you. There's this part. Dunaway-esque. Brilliant. A she-devil that'd eat her own young. A killer instinct that comes in handy when werewolves take over her mining town. But they're not just fucking werewolves. They're a metaphor for economic predation in the wake of the collapse of the industrial economy. Sure, she said. Unsure whether or not to take him seriously, but happy for the moment to believe that a real career might finally come to her. It's fun to play the heavy. I don't play, honey, he said. Then, with a wink, took his leave to pursue a passing tray of hamburger sliders. Across the yard, Nicolas Cage assailed Natchez Gushu. A Stone Age axe and a saber-toothed tiger skeleton are coming up for auction in Shanghai. Seeing them triggered some crazy visions or memories or whatever. I think I've lived many lives, Natchez. I think I've been saving humanity for a while now. I look forward to hearing about it. You should come by the bungalow. But it's urgent. I'm really just here to enjoy the party. You know how big a saber-toothed tiger is? Imagine two of them, one on either side of me. I wear a furry loincloth. My torso ripples muscles. I'm 7% body fat at this point. I carry this giant Stone Age axe. Then, wandering these wastelands, I encounter, oh God, this vision. It's so awful. It's aliens. Have you dreamed this too? Their spaceship is sleek, black, small, like a scout mission. Their bodies poised to strike like giant pythons. My saber tooths attack, eager to defend me. The aliens kill them with their red plasma beams, to which, once again, I'm immune. Only now I have no fear. I go fucking berserk. Nick's eyeballs bulged. I'm hacking away at them with my axe, guts squirting everywhere. Shall we get another drink? I slaughter them, Natchez. I kill them all, or at least the guys on the ground. The spaceship lifts off. As it rises, this voice comes out of the air. It speaks to me. Natchez sighed, a cocktail hour hostage. What does it say, Nick? It says, see you in Malibu when the clock ticks no more. There was dinner in the garden, a long table set for 50, adorned with plum and lotus blossoms. Anthony Hopkins was given a place of honor beside Carrie. Hopkins watched as the star stuffed his face with his bare hands, devouring chunks of suckling pig, indifferent to the plum sauce smeared across his jowls. Then a piece of grizzle flew out of Carrie's mouth, landing grossly on the lapel of the white suit that Hopkins hadn't cleaned since the day at Yale when Elise declined his proposal. He could take no more. You're borrowing from the Grinch, he leaned low and scolded, enraged that the jacket would now require cleaning. Pick up your fork and eat like a head of state. Carrie froze with a fried piglet's ear dangling from his craw, his own insecurities feeding the rush of an undeniably Maoist rage. First, he was livid at Hopkins for dressing him down in front of his peers. In ego defense, he decided Anthony was jealous of him, of his talent, his youth. But then paranoia bubbled up within rage. What if Hopkins was secretly against him, trying to make a fool of him? What if others were involved, co-conspirators? What if this was the story they'd used to detract from his performance? Carrie wasn't Mao, they'd say. He was just the Grinch. That's it. That's what they'd used to deny him his due when award season came. Bastards. He scanned the table, reading every face for signs of betrayal. And then, just as quickly as rage had turned to paranoia, paranoia turned, as it does, to want of triumph. A colossal will formed within him, a determination to show Hopkins and everyone else that he was not only a fine actor, but the finest of his generation. He'd planned to give a dinner toast laced with Marxist criticisms, comments against American capitalism, vampiric imperialism, just edgy enough to scare off the Disney execs, his class enemies, the same who'd crushed his father, who'd have broken him in the Toronto factories if he hadn't escaped. Now he decided to make the air truly unbreathable for them. He rose from his chair, bone-dry desert wind rustling the leaves of the maples, an impish grin taking hold as he raised his wine glass. America is a failing fascist Ponzi scheme. The table quieted, silver fork settling on porcelain. He imagined himself a great dragon spewing fire. It doesn't take care of its sick, doesn't care for its poor, doesn't protect its children, abandons its veterans and its elderly. America's very God is a fraud, invented by marauding settlers to justify native genocide, a savage deity blessing a savage people, forgiving the napalming of babies in Vietnam, the starvation of 500,000 Iraqis in our own lives. And who at this table lost 5 seconds even thinking about that? No. We drown that out with our positive personal affirmations. We don't even look after our own. The people who work 15 hours a day doing our makeup, hair, and wardrobe have to invoice the studios 6 or 7 times before they get paid. They beg while someone siphons interest off their money. And whose fucking idea was a 15-hour day in the first place? Wink and Al watched, aghast, hoping this was all a bit. wondering when Carrie would switch to family-friendly impressions. Carrie looked down the table of gathered stars, his peers. Jack Nicholson, his close friend, Noah Emmerich, Dame Helen Mirren, Brad and Angelina, and, just as Mal would have, leveled charges while holding out the chance of redemption. "Once we were artists, pure, but we, all of us, we became a distraction, compromised for the sake of fame, comfort, the approval of strangers. We spend our lives pursuing something as empty as relevance, and they use our fear of losing it to corral us. Dirty Malaysian money, Saudi money, we'll take it all. What went wrong? We sing and dance not to entertain, but to distract people from the crushing gears of a capitalist machine that has no ideals save for greed and violence. And let's not kid ourselves. Hollywood is the best PR firm the gun makers ever had. What a sick culture." "But what about artistic beauty?" asked Cameron Diaz. "When you can perceive beauty, there's no excuse for serving ugliness, for aiding cons, inflaming desires, promising everything and delivering nothing. It doesn't matter what you put on TV because people are so frightened and lonely, they'll watch it just to hear human voices and feel like they're not alone. They're so beaten down. All they need is a soccer tournament every 4 years and they stay in their place. This is not a society. This is a system of soul murder. And history will not be kind to us for our complicity because we know better. The executives," he nodded mauishly to the Disney team, "they can say they were serving their god Mammon, but we artists can't. We're all East German playwrights now, complicit with the regime, and there will come a time of judgment. We're destroying the planet. This cannot last." Leonardo DiCaprio, who had long shared these feelings, raised his martini Gatsby style and cheered. "Global warming is a fever meant to kill a virus." He was so enthralled by Carrie's bravery that he accepted it when the star, now veering deep into Mao, continued in the slightest Cantonese accent. "The American citizen is so lost he doesn't realize he's a factory pig, drugged and poisoned from the cradle to the grave, chained to impossible debts, never ever free. Liberty? Bah! This is a land of invisible fences. We're all prisoners watching Capra on movie night. But nothing lasts forever. Europe's monarchies sent their sons to die in the trenches of the Somme, just as surely as we drove Chiang Kai-shek into the sea. You think America will be different? You think this era, one not of consumption but of gluttony, will last forever? It will not. We're going 6,000 miles an hour around the sun and nobody's driving this bitch," said Gary Busey from the woods where, for his own reasons, he was halfway up an 80-foot pine tree. "There will come another crisis soon," continued Carrie. "The capitalist scheme will collapse. The people will reclaim their rights. There will be violent unrest. Ask yourselves, which side am I on? That of the people or of the billionaires and their running dogs whose heads, I promise, will end up on sticks? The revolution begins now. The death of false gods." His peers cheered him madly. Carrie was Mao as he'd seen him on YouTube, standing before the Chinese Communist Congress, receiving endless flows of love, the adulation making him something more than a man, a vessel of longing, of dreams. Georgie gazed at him fondly for the first time in weeks, then nodded to the waiters. They hustled into the kitchen and came out bearing the coup de grace. Two large cakes, half life-size, one of Mickey Mouse, one of Minnie, each impaled on a jagged chocolate-bark pikestaff, raspberry filling oozing down into puddles from their open wounds. The guests roared even louder. If not exactly at the call to violent revolution, this was, after all, a gathering of millionaires, then at his very gusto, his defiant, ballsiness. Jane Fonda, recognizing this all as a performance, made sharp whooping sounds unheard since her photo ops with the Viet Cong. Through gritted teeth with a raw sexual hunger, Laura Flynn Boyle said, "I want to cut him." Meanwhile, Kelsey Grammer, who had been warming up his vocal cords with soft humming through most of Jim's speech, raised his glass to ejaculate lines from Shakespeare. "Let Hercules himself do what he may. The cat will mew and the dog will have his day." "Damn it, Kelsey," said Natchez Gushu. "Allow the man his moment." "What?" protested Grammer. "Does he get to just suck up the whole evening?" Kerry knew now, totally, that he had it within him. The magnetic Maoist stuff. He wondered, with perfect grandiosity, if the Mao was not just prelude to a greater historic role. Ronald Reagan had won the White House, and Reagan was just a wooden day player compared with him. The Disney executives, fearing proximity to this kind of trademark sacrilege, rose from their seats, faces twisted in careerist fear, and fled the patio as the actors photographed the grisly cakes, sending them viral. "What did you do?" said Wink, who couldn't look at the confections for too long without risking memories of Nicaragua. Kerry glowered at him, smugly satisfied. "Sick fucks getting off on this," said Al Spielman II, who as a pillar of the business community was appalled, but as stress eater was eyeing the raspberry filling that oozed down Minnie's breasts from the gaping wound in her head. "He's lost his mind," said Wink, pulling Al by the arm to follow the Disney executives, assuring them this was just some Andy Kaufman shit that Jim had cooked up, that in time they'd tell their grandkids about it, and a couple of disturbing cakes shouldn't interfere with business. No sooner had they left than a great rumbling sounded from the Mojave, a noise like the grinding of vast metal plates. People had been hearing it all summer. Jaden Smith, who had recently become a flat earther, offered his theory that it was cosmic wind by